So comforting was Miss Marple that in one of the stories from The 13 Problems, Agatha had the confidence to plant her in a hydro. This was an oblique reference to Harrogate, made very shortly after the event, and one of the male characters helps to lance the boil of memory by declaring that hydros are absolutely beastly, got to get up early and drink filthy-tasting water. Lot of old women sitting about, ill-natured tittle-tattle. Miss Marple freely admits the truth of this, as if she would not have known that Mrs. Christie was sitting opposite her in the lounge, and exactly why she was there. Then she launches into a very characteristic defence. Talking scandal, as you say. Well, it is done a good deal. And people are very down on it, especially young people. But what I say is that none of these young people ever stop to think. They really don't examine the facts. Surely, the whole crux of the matter is this. How often is tittle-tattle, as you call it, true? And I think if, as I say, they really examined the facts, they would find that this was true 9 times out of 10. That's really just what makes people so annoyed about it.
The inspired guess, said Sir Henry.
No, not that at all. It's really a matter of practice and experience. What my nephew calls superfluous women have a lot of time on their hands, and their chief interest is usually people. And so, you see, they get to be what one might call experts. Now, young people nowadays, they talk very freely about things that weren't mentioned in my young days, but on the other hand, their minds are terribly innocent. They believe in everyone and everything. Agatha herself had believed and trusted. She had suspected nothing. How she had needed Miss Marple by her side, to hint delicately that a man who wishes to play golf quite so often, well, of course, one wonders. Now it was too late. And although she would never have guessed it, Agatha was about to plunge again. She returned to Ur in February 1930, at the end of the digging season, having forged a firm friendship with the Woolleys. The previous May, the couple had stayed at her new London house, a charming little mews at 22 Creswell Place, off the old Brompton Road, which she had bought in 1928. A radiantly green spring tree among grey roofs was how the Star described it. The house still had its stables until Agatha had it redesigned. A large room downstairs and above, a tiny kitchen, dining room, bedroom, and marvellous green bathroom painted with dolphins. Soon she would buy another house, at 478 Camden Street in Kensington, then three more in the 1930s. The pre-war years were indeed, as she later said, her plutocratic period, before taxation prevented her keeping the better part of the money she earned. In 1929, Agatha's brother Monty died, and she herself was very ill after a vaccination, which she believed to have been double strength, against Rosalind's measles. However, after spending the end of the year at Ashfield, she felt ready for more adventure. Travelling was in her blood now. Much as she loved her home, she became restless if she stayed in England too long. This time at Ur, she met a member of the expedition who had been away the previous season with appendicitis. Max Mallowan. If he had been there the year before, it would have been too soon for her after Archie, says his biographer. When Max met Agatha, he was 25, the same age as her nephew Jack Watts, whose contemporary he had been at New College. Max was so much younger than Agatha that she viewed him from a benign distance, although she noted his tact with the Woolleys and thought him clever. She got to know him better when Catherine, in typical autocratic fashion, ordered him to take Agatha on a tour of the local sites, on the way from Ur to Baghdad. Agatha was somewhat embarrassed, thinking that this poor young man was being imposed upon. Max, however, was unperturbed, and the two discovered that they got along. Catherine Woolley was by now revealing the oddity of her character. She had had an unusual life. Half German on her father's side, she had gone up to Somerville in 1910 to read history, although she did not take her degree, and met her first husband while working in a prison camp during the First World War. Within 6 months of the wedding in 1919,
Colonel Keeling shot himself. After this, Catherine, who was highly intelligent and a gifted artist, nearly an artist, wrote Agatha in her autobiography, a trifle cattily, gravitated towards archaeology, which was at that time a small, amateurish and gentlemanly world. She became part of the setup at Ur as a volunteer assistant, but women were rare creatures on digs, and after a while, pressure was put on Leonard Woolley to regularize the situation. He and Catherine were married in 1927. Although 2 years older than Agatha, Catherine looked far younger and was still extremely beautiful. Yet she lacked all normal sexual feeling. Her first husband's suicide may well have been linked to this. The extent of Woolley's congress with his wife was apparently to watch her having a bath at night. The fact that he did this gives the lie to the bizarre rumour that Catherine was in truth a man. However, if Catherine had no desire to sleep with men, she still wanted them in her thrall. The young men on the dig at Ur, including Max, would be commanded to brush her hair. They actually found this really embarrassing, oppressive, but impossible to refuse, said Agatha's friend, Dr. Joan Oates. It was really very, very peculiar. Catherine would also ask them to walk 10 miles or so to the souk and buy 2 kilos of her favourite Arab confectionery. This had its own advantages, however, as the sweets would keep her quiet for a day or two. She used to eat the whole lot and then be sick. Hardly the behaviour of a femme fatale, yet such Catherine undoubtedly was, and it fascinated Agatha, so much so that she wrote her friend into murder in Mesopotamia as the victim. We all thought that was a marvellous way of getting back at someone that you couldn't get back at any other way, says Joan Oates. The portrayal of Louise Leidner is unusually for Agatha absolutely that of a real person, and this knocks the book slightly off balance, not least because the actual solution is one of Agatha's weakest. What interests her is not the detective puzzle, but the mystery of this singular woman, an illumineuse, as she is called, whose delight is to inflame passion, not to experience it. I was convinced, says Poirot, that Mrs. Leidner was a woman who essentially worshipped herself, and who enjoyed more than anything else the sense of power. Wherever she was, she must be the centre of the universe. Another character says of her that she didn't really care a damn, and that's why I hate her so. She's not sensual. She doesn't want affairs. She's a kind of female Iago. She must have drama, but she doesn't want to be involved herself. She's always outside, pulling strings, looking on, enjoying it. This, then, was Catherine Woolley. Beautiful, clever, fiercely independent, destructive. But Agatha's writerly instinct made her push the character further. She imagined what would happen if Catherine were to meet her match and fall helplessly in love. She imagined, too, a streak that was fatalistic to the point of self-destruction. Beneath the detective fiction ending, there is a strange, subtle hint that Louise Leidner had placed herself in a situation that invites her own death. Simple in plot, complex in characterization, this book, like 2 or 3 other Christies, would have made a magnificent Mary Westmacott. Its narrative voice, that of Nurse Amy Leatheren, is determinedly prosaic, a foil to Mrs. Leidner's weary allure. She sounds a little death knell for Archie Christie when told that Mrs. Leidner's first husband was killed in the war. I think that's very pathetic and romantic, don't you, Nurse? To which she replies, it's one way of calling a goose a swan. In other words, if the man had lived, if Archie had stayed, there would have been time for glamour to fade into curmudgeonly middle age. So Nurse Leatheren speaks for a side of Agatha, the plain and sane side. This can also be seen in the character's reaction to the East. Frankly, what had struck me was the mess everywhere, and to archaeology. Would you believe it, there was nothing to see but mud. Dirty mud walls about 2 feet high, and that's all there was to it. Mr. Carey took me here and there telling me things. All I thought was, but how does he know? This was not, of course, exactly what Agatha thought. She was entranced with work on the dig, sporting in her attitude to so-called bathrooms and non-European hygiene. There was nothing parochial about her whatsoever, yet she understood the parochial mind. This indeed was part of her genius, and relished its homely good sense. She too would have her sceptical moments in the face of Leonard Woolley's blind assurance that he was digging at the site of the flood. But how did he know? He did not. He was wrong. What she liked about archaeology were the moments despised by intellectuals like Woolley when past came to meet present, and the buried fragments of human daily life were magically lifted into the air. Also, in Murder in Mesopotamia, there is a hint of how Agatha perceived the young Max Mallowan, semi-portrayed as David Emmett, the quiet American who refuses to be bullied by Miss Leidner and earns her grudging respect. I may say that of all the expedition, as far as character and capacity were concerned, Mr. Emmett seemed to me the most fitted to bring a clever and well-timed crime off satisfactorily, says Poirot. An oblique semi-compliment. In fact, Max was rather more under Catherine's spell than his fictional counterpart. The portrait of David Emmett was somewhat idealized, although Agatha shared Amy Leatherin's view that there was something about him that seemed very steadfast and reassuring. She enjoyed her time sightseeing with him in Iraq. A kind of friendly intimacy was established, not least because of what she described as the strenuous way of living. Max was required to escort Agatha to the lavatory when they stayed the night at the police post at Kabala, sleeping in separate cells, and on the dreary road to Ukedir, they sang songs before stripping off to their underwear to bathe in a desert lake. Agatha was relaxed with Max from early on, probably because the age difference dispersed the usual male-female tensions. Her joy of living returned during this strange journey through hot, exotic, dreamlike landscapes. The whole thing was fun, which was not something Agatha had experienced for a very long time. Dashing and handsome, though he undoubtedly was, Archie had never been fun. It felt like an interlude, surprising, serendipitous, and she felt not to be repeated. Yet there would be a further opportunity. Agatha was travelling through Greece with the Woolleys, Catherine somewhat vexed at her friend's closeness to her protégé, when a bundle of telegrams arrived at Athens to say that Rosalind was extremely ill with pneumonia. Agatha panicked, no doubt from guilt, then fell over and sprained her ankle, whereupon Max announced that she would need a companion on her journey and he would return to England with her. Throughout the four-day train journey, no flights in those days, the two got to know each other properly. Max knew a certain amount already, of course, but the whole Archie Harrogate business would have sailed over his head. Not so for the rest of the world, whose judgment upon her had turned Agatha defensive and brittle. A woman who met her at the time wrote in her diary, "Mrs. Christie is actually Agatha. Rather nice, very hard." But Max divined the childlike vulnerability within. He understood her very well, in fact. He set about gaining her confidence. Max himself was an extremely assured person, despite his lack of apparent advantages. He was short, physically unimpressive, and his background would not have been considered comme il faut by the people with whom he wished to mix. The Woolleys, as he wrote in his memoirs, were both snobs. Yet people of this kind tend to work harder at making themselves liked, and this was Max's great gift. He could handle anyone. "I foresee that you will always be able to manage me," Agatha wrote to him in 1930. He took the trouble to understand what every situation required, then supplied it. When he first met Agatha, he perceived that she was raw and bruised, and without being in any way obvious about it, soothed her. He made himself indispensable, although he never made himself cheap. His nephew John has described him as a lucky person in general, but as the cliché has it, he made his own luck. Unlike those who are more naturally attractive, who tend to assume that luck will come their way, He set himself to do the right thing with the right people, and thus rose high. As an adult, Max was very much the Englishman, with his membership of Boodles and collection of 18th-century silver, but his lineage was wholly continental. His clever manners were not those of a typical Englishman, neither were his instinctive tastes. He had, for example, a passion for Prokofiev and Rachmaninoff. He also had what A.L. Rouse called Austrian charm. His grandfather, also named Max, was of Slav origin and lived as a refugee in Vienna until 1879, when he was naturalized. By this time he had married a Czech girl and become a mill owner. But when the mill burned down, the family was left nearly destitute. In 1897, his son Frederick, Max's father, cut his losses and came to London. He had served in the Austrian army, from which he only obtained his certificate of release in 1913, but by that time he had become entirely British in his loyalties. In 1902, he married a French girl, Marguerite Duvivier, who had come to London as a companion. Her background was also unusual. Her mother, Martha, had been an opera singer performing Salome in the first production of Massenet's L'Hérodiade. The Malouins were not, in fact, especially well-suited. Marguerite was an emotional woman, religious and highly devoted to her three sons, Max, the eldest, Cecil, and Philip. Frederick was far more disciplined in his attitude to life. He had a dueling scar on his skull, and although he became a businessman, he remained very much the foreign soldier. Max was extremely close to his mother, as Agatha had been to hers. Later she would envy him his relationship with Marguerite. "I went away horribly jealous of you having a mother to meet you, and later still be somewhat irritated by it." But he certainly did not enjoy the childhood that would support and occasionally torment Agatha with its idyllic memories. He grew up in London, and his life lacked what he termed domestic peace. His parents argued a great deal. "I am indebted to both father and mother," he wrote, "for inclining my temperament towards peaceful companionship." Just as the happy marriage of Agatha's parents had led her to take her own for granted, so Max learned by example that marriage required courtesy and effort. He went to Lansing, where he was a contemporary of Evelyn Waugh and Tom Dryberg, a very exceptional generation, Waugh later wrote. Then read greats at New College. "The transition from Lansing to Oxford University, where I spent 4 years, 1921 to 1925, was a step from purgatory to paradise." Max belonged to the Brideshead era, and within his means he behaved accordingly. He got a 4th in mods and a 3rd in finals. He threw what he called Derby winner parties, backing the right horse 3 years in succession, and he met his own Sebastian Flight, a glamorous and aristocratic Catholic with whom he had a deep, powerful friendship. Esme Howard, eldest son of Lord Howard of Penrith, was not Max's lover, but he was the closest that Max came to this relationship before he met Agatha. "I feel," he wrote to her in 1930, "that my love for you is the perfect continuation of that friendship with Esme that I thought I should never recover." Like many clever, inexperienced young men, he found it easier and more congenial to fall in love for the first time with another man. Certainly Esme was a far more romantic figure than the average female undergraduate. He was brilliant, sweet, and fatally sick. He died aged 25 of Hodgkin's disease. Max visited him for the last time at Portofino in the Dowager Lady Carnarvon's villa, as he wrote in his memoirs. Coincidentally, he endured a dark night of the soul at around the same time as Agatha. Esme had died 5 days before Agatha disappeared from Sunningdale and found the same remedy for grief in intensely hard work. He also made a deathbed promise to Esme that he would take on his friend's religion. Technically, Max was a Catholic through his French mother, but he had never taken communion and refused to be confirmed when a pupil at Lansing. Now, love overcame rationality. Having seen the strength that Esme, the true saint, derived from his religion, Max was convinced that he too should seek faith in God. The irony was that Agatha, who had always attended church, would no longer take communion after her divorce. The further irony was that Max reneged on his promise to Esme when he learned that the Catholic Church would not recognize his marriage to Agatha. In fact, his nature was never that of a devout Catholic. "I always have a feeling that God is good and giving me his divine protection," he wrote to Agatha during the war, and that was the extent of his religious feeling. He was a questioner, a lover of high table talk rather than contemplation, a lover of beauty in art, history, flesh, rather than in the spiritual realm. He was also ambitious. Like Charles Ryder, he had to use chance and connections to get on in life. When he casually expressed interest in archaeology, led, via the Dean of New College and the keeper of the Ashmolean Museum, to an interview with Leonard Woolley in the summer of 1925, he determined to make as much as possible of the meeting. With Woolley that day at the British Museum was Catherine Keeling. Max was sharp enough to realize that he had to impress them both. His gift did not let him down, and he began to work at Ur in the autumn. 4 years later, he had the sense to make friends with the lonely, likable, well-to-do Mrs. Christie. He did not move too fast. He simply established himself as the companion Agatha needed. He told her she had a noble face, a charmingly tentative compliment of the kind that clever young men offer to older women. After a hurried parting at Paris, where Max met up with his mother, and Agatha went home to Rosalind, she found herself, as he had intended, unable to forget him. In the spring of 1930, Max was working with Woolley at the British Museum. He wrote to Agatha at Ashfield, asking her to visit London, the pretext being that objects excavated from Ur were on display at the museum, and she might like to see them. Her reply was intriguingly passionate, flustered, and childlike. "My Rosalind was much worse than they had told me. It wrung my heart to see her, skin and bones and pitifully weak. Oh, Max, everything has been beastly, like coming back into the worst kind of unquiet dream. Can't you come down here some weekend, Max? I can't have parties or ask ordinary people, but you're such an angel." The letter ended with an invitation to breakfast at Creswell Place. Agatha was visiting London for a series of meetings. In her autobiography, she wrote calmly about the reunion with Max, saying that she felt shy seeing him again, but was very pleased not to be losing touch. The tone of her letters, however, is different. "I feel quite homesick for you," she wrote, and gave away secrets that she told nobody else, for example about the Mary Westmacott pseudonym. "Don't tell anyone, will you? Not even your mother. Giant's Bread has been awfully well received, which is rather marvellous for me, isn't it?" Quite plainly, she had feelings for this young man, although she might not have been aware of them. She purported to have felt absolute surprise when, not long after the London meeting, Max visited Ashfield and, just as Archie had done almost 16 years earlier, marched into her bedroom and proposed to her. "It had never occurred to me that Max and I would be or ever could be on those terms. We were friends." Yet within no time at all, she had accepted the idea of a second marriage. She had not been without male attention since the split with Archie. Her husband might have wanted youth and unblemished beauty, but other men were less fussy. Indeed, the sexual culture as a whole was, in some ways, more robust than it is today. It was less obsessed with physical perfection, more with straightforward availability. As a divorced woman, Agatha was assumed to be in the market. A male acquaintance made a remark to her that found its way into Unfinished Portrait. "You'll have either to take a lover or lovers. You will have to decide which it's to be." In the book, Celia thinks that lovers would be best. You'd be almost safe with lovers. In other words, a procession of men could not get close enough to hurt her in the way that Archie had done. That must never happen again. There is no evidence, however, that Agatha succumbed to any of the passes that were made in her late 30s. It is as certain as it can be that she slept with only two men in her life. Unfinished Portrait says that after Dermot, she tried to learn to be alone, and the book would not lie about such a thing. If there was an affair to confess, this would have been the place to do it. In her autobiography, Agatha wrote very openly that she was pleased about the passes. She always had an uncomplicated liking for men, and got along with them easily, so long as there was no real emotional attachment. She told a rather charming story about a Dutch engineer whom she met on her first journey on the Orient Express. After they had had dinner together one night, he looked at her and said, "I wonder now. No, I think it would be wiser if I do not ask." To this she replied, "I think you are very wise and very kind." But the question had been in the air. It was like the hotel scene in Destination Unknown. A good-looking young Frenchman came out of the bar and across the terrace, cast a swift, discreet glance at Hilary, which, thinly disguised, meant, "Is there anything doing here, I wonder?" Agatha took all this on board. In some ways, she was very worldly, utterly unlike the grandmotherly image she later cultivated. "You know, you're the sort of woman who ought to be raped," is a line spoken to the prim Joan Scudamore in Absent in the Spring. "I'd like to rape you myself and see if you looked the least bit different afterwards." Agatha, or Mary Westmacott, could write this kind of thing without embarrassment, and, more to the point, without inducing embarrassment in her reader. Yet with Max Mallowan, 14 years her junior, Agatha was almost as senior to him as he was to Rosalind, she became as defenseless as a child. "I think you will marry me, you know," he said, when he left her bedroom at Ashfield, after what Agatha described in her autobiography as hours of talking. He had made the running and prepared the ground, and he was fully confident as to the outcome. "Of course, I'm wise," he wrote to her soon afterwards. "Wisdom is my chief defence, and that's why I've yanked you out of the stalls, as you put it." For her part, Agatha began writing to Max like an excitable young girl. She seemed instantly seized by the idea of spending her life with him. An idea that had, according to her autobiography, come as a complete shock. "Dearest, do I really mean what you say to you? I've just got your letter. Oh, my dear, I would love to mean that to you, and I too feel the same, that being with you is a kind of freedom." This was an example of Max's extreme cleverness at providing Agatha with what she needed from a putative relationship, something utterly unlike her first marriage. Luckily for Max, as he could not have competed with Archie in the romance stakes. She wanted to feel both liberated and reassured. "When we are companion dogs, the world seems a wonderful place, a rich freedom. There is no feeling of restraint or captivity or being tied down. I would never have believed anything could be like it." Her willingness to write these things was desperately touching in the light of the terrible betrayal she had suffered. Yet there was a sense in which she was writing for Max as a thank you. It is almost impossible that he should have unleashed such intense feelings so incredibly quickly. The love letters that led up to the marriage are, in fact, a performance on both sides. "It is obviously decreed that you should be my sunflower," was the kind of thing that Max wrote to Agatha. Not exactly insincere, but not the usual tone of love letters, such as the ones that Archie wrote, which labour under an exquisite male sense of strain. Of course, Agatha and Max were not usual lovers. Nothing about this courtship was normal. The most interesting irony was that the dominant partner should have been Agatha. She had the money and the experience. Max had not a penny, and was almost certainly a virgin. Yet it was he who took charge. He assumed the parental role. He did not need a mother figure, having a perfectly devoted mother of his own. But this was exactly what Agatha needed, and Max knew it. He was not so much an emotional substitute for Archie as for Clara, the person whom Agatha missed more than any other. With Clara, She had been completely herself, free of any demands to restrain her nature, able to let her imagination take flight in the secure knowledge that her mother was there at Ashfield, the centre of the real world. With Max, she recaptured something of this feeling, the sense that life was safe. He enabled her to behave like a child again. This suited him very well, as he was a natural teacher and delighted in telling Agatha that she should learn Greek, read Gibbon, and take drawing lessons to help on the dig. He wrote to her about Rosalind, saying, "She is more grown up than you, isn't she, Angel?" And, knowing very well what she wanted to hear, "Agatha, I don't love you merely with the glorious eyes of the blind, but I see you as you are." "I do believe you love me for what I am," she replied, before adding this note of sobriety. "Mere love is rather an idiotic business, approved of by nature, but capable of inflicting a lot of unhappiness on individuals. But you are my friend, Max." In a strange way, the age difference made Agatha better able to cope, even though it was minimized to 6 years on the marriage certificate. Agatha was 37, Max 31. She lamented it loudly, "Your damnable silly age," but in fact it rendered Max less threatening. Nothing about him would resemble her marriage to Archie, who would never have written to say, "If you feel serious, my Ange, remember that life together will be a glorious joke if only we choose to make it so." She was anxious, however, that the joke should not be on her. She had already been made to look ridiculous in the eyes of the world. Her sister was adamantly against the marriage and did not hesitate to tell Agatha so. Max never really forgave the Wattses for this. 2 weeks before the wedding, Madge sent a present of handkerchiefs. It is not suggested that they will be useful for mopping tears, let it be clearly understood. She hoped that Max would take care of her sister. If not, one of his old mummies will arise and deal with the matter, which I have been led to understand that the said mummies thoroughly understood. Jack Watts, who was very fond of Agatha, had never liked Max at Oxford. Both he and Madge were suspicious of Max's motives, and viewed him as a fortune hunter. This thought must have occurred to Agatha herself, particularly when she read his letters about their honeymoon, which he was planning and for which she was paying. They were heading for Venice. "I am having a white blazer made in anticipation of warm sojour, through what was then Yugoslavia and on to Greece. I wish I had time to learn to play the shepherd's pipe." Meanwhile, Max wrote to Agatha about the registrar's fees for the actual wedding, because it's right that I should pay for all that. The ceremony was due to take place in September at St. Columba's Church in Edinburgh. The religious question was resolved quite easily on Max's side, less so on Agatha's. "You are still sure of yourself, aren't you? I mean about the religious side. You've no qualms of conscience or guilty feeling." She continued to dither through the summer of 1930. "One moment a bit of blind panic. I feel, I won't marry anybody. Never again. But it's Max. It's being with Max and having him always, to hold on to when I feel unhappy." This pattern was repeated even as plans for the wedding advanced. At the end of August, she went on holiday to Skye with Rosalind, Carlo and Mary Fisher, who would be witnesses, then moved down to Edinburgh. From Skye she wrote of the madness of exchanging mediocre but safe happiness for great happiness but possible disaster. "You see, Max, dear, I do so hate being unhappy. Oh, my dear, be very, very sure. We could always be friends, you know, even if we didn't marry." Again, this has the slight air of the performance, although the feelings beneath it were genuine. But it was designed to get a response of the type at which Max excelled. "You are to go on being brave for another fortnight so that you may be the happiest Ange in all of the world." In fact, Max never really doubted that Agatha would go through with the wedding. The one time that she did seem to want to call it off, he played the man's trump card and withdrew contact. "You are a pig, Max. 3 days since you left and not one word from you. You know, You can't really care. Oh, Max, which resolved the situation. Max's greater worry before September was probably the Woolies' reaction. He still needed their patronage, even if only for one more season. And he craved the goodwill of Catherine, however much he disparaged her to Agatha. It is impossible to know what he felt towards her during the years at Ur. But the portrait of Louise Leidner in Murder in Mesopotamia is of a deeply alluring woman, and an inexperienced young man such as Max might well have been susceptible. Agatha had had an inkling of this after her first sightseeing tour with Max. She returned to Baghdad, longing for a hot bath. Max drew one for her, then offered it to Catherine. As late as 1943, Agatha would write to him on the 14th of February saying, "Have you remembered to send your Valentine to Kay Woolley?" She made a joke of it, but was Max's behaviour really so funny? In May 1930, he was insistent that he and Agatha should both write to Catherine with the dire news of their engagement. Her reply was gracious. "It is lovely to know that two people I love so much as you two are going to be so happy." Although revenge would come later. Catherine did say that Max should be forced to wait before the marriage, as it would be bad for him to get everything he wanted so quickly. This was a perceptive, if outrageously rude, remark, but keeping men keen was not Agatha's style. As she wrote to Max, "It's no good. I shall never have proper Kay-like Olympian attitude towards the male sex. I shall either think that they are pigs or else perfect darlings." She had the Kay-like allure once, of course, in the days when men like Reggie Lucy had fallen at her buttoned boots. Now she was tired, lonely, and intensely grateful. Somehow she knew that despite everything, this alliance with Max would suit her. It would restore her wrecked confidence. "See, Archie, I can still get myself a husband, 15 years younger than you." And it would allow her the freedom she cherished. It would not interfere with her writing, as Max was far too sensible to do such a thing, and far too confident to be jealous of her success. It would not oblige her to change herself in any way, as she so obviously should have done with Archie. She worried nonetheless about her fading looks and her weight, although she tried to make a joke of it. "Perhaps I am Little Piglet, your favourite size. Do say I am." Later, Max would tease her a good deal about this. But now he wrote, "I know you are very beautiful," and she loved him for the lie. Above all, marriage would provide companionship. For this, she would take the many risks. She craved solitude, but not infinite solitude. And those bleak, sad years of the late 1920s had nearly killed her, going to bed alone, seeing her aging face and body in the mirror, trying to make a life out of friendships and parties, remembering life as it had once been, clinging to Peter, as if only his love came between her and nothingness. Now this little smiling man had come along to save her. "Bless you, my love," he wrote to her on the 6th of September, 5 days before the wedding. "I want you to be as happy as I am, and I think you will be, my darling." This was kindness, and she drank it in like water in the desert. She would be a better wife to him than she had been to Archie, because she was not in love with him. Nor was he in love with her. They were together for reasons other than love, and this, she thought, might very well make for greater happiness. She wrote as much a year after their marriage, when she was working on Lord Edgware Dies. The words are Poirot's, the reasoning Agatha's. "And suppose he marries a girl who loves him passionately. Is there such a great advantage in that? Often I have observed that it is a great misfortune for a man to have a wife who loves him. She creates the scenes of jealousy, she makes him look ridiculous, she insists on having all his time and attention. Ah, no, it is not the bed of roses." So she became, in a way, a realist. She compromised. After the happy honeymoon, so many lovely things, she accepted the call of the Woolies upon Max, and his instant jump to their attention. They behaved very badly, in fact, as they had done all along. The devils are going to do their best not to make it easy for us, as Max put it. Agatha recognized that Leonard was merely weak, and she blamed Catherine. She also wrote, "Kay, I think, is jealous not of happiness, but simply and only of money." Woolley extracted the last ounce of work from Max before the wedding, made him sit up and draw pottery practically the night before they were married, says Joan Oates, then recalled him to Baghdad on the 15th of October. This would have been all right, but Agatha had fallen ill in Athens on the last days of the honeymoon. It was a kind of food poisoning, apparently brought on by joyful eating of crevettes and langoustines. And it was very serious. Agatha was taken into hospital, and Max left for work. "The doctor has just been," she wrote to him from Greece, where the treatment cost her a fortune, "and there is no doubt from the coldness of his manner that he regards you as a brutal and inhuman being. My poor Max, and you so kind and tender to your ange." What she really thought is impossible to know. Of course, the Woolleys, Catherine, were to blame for terrorizing Max into such craven obedience, especially as they themselves did not turn up at Baghdad for another week. But should he not have said that his loyalties were now to Agatha? She herself insisted that he return to Baghdad. Nevertheless, she would surely have liked him to insist that he stay with her. "Don't forget to tell me exactly how you are and whether you really are free from all traces of that poisoning," he wrote in his precise way. Then, "I don't think I dread meeting the Woolleys half as much as I did. I feel more aloof and independent now that I have my ange to think of." She kept wisely silent on the subject for 5 years before referring, in Death in the Clouds, to an Englishman whose wife had been taken ill. He himself had to be somewhere in Iraq by a certain date. Eh bien, would you believe it? He left his wife and went on. The English girl to whom this story is told replies, "One's work has to come first, I suppose." But the mere fact that Agatha brought up the incident suggests it had rankled. Despite Max's dutiful return from his honeymoon, relations with the Woolleys were unsalvageable. It was Catherine who would not only forbade Agatha to come to Ur, but said she was not allowed to come to Iraq at all, says Joan Oates, because Max had suggested that she should stay in a hotel in Baghdad and he could go off on the occasional weekend and see her. This, it was made clear, would not be possible. Woolley himself had hinted as much when dining with Agatha before the wedding. It was quite mad, but it really did not matter very much. Max was in a position to get work elsewhere, and this would be his last season at Ur. He had gained experience with Leonard Woolley. He had gained a wife. Through his marriage, he became a man of means. The future was bright for him. For Agatha, who wrote to him from London where her journey finally ended, "It is the first time for several years that I have arrived in England without a feeling of misery. My dear, you have lifted so much from my shoulders, so much that I didn't even know was there. I can feel the wounds healing all over. They are still there, and very little would open them again." This was perhaps a reminder to Max that she was still vulnerable. Back at Ashfield, where Rosalind had coolly accepted her mother's new status, saying, "I think it's rather a good thing having two sets of parents," she wrote, "I couldn't bear you ever to be less nice than you are now. I think men often are their best at about your age. They have a finer vision and a bigger ideal of life, and then very often life narrows them. They get egotistical, self-centered, petty, self-indulgent, and censorious. You mustn't. You must always be Max." She was happy, though. "Everyone had said I look very well and 10 years younger, and that being married to you suits me." What also suited may have been that she was married but had her own life while Max was away. She was free, but she was safe, just like in the old days. A letter from November 1930 bubbles over with effervescence. "Have just had the most exciting and reprehensible day. I have been to a sale. Oh, I have enjoyed myself. a lovely Chippendale tall boys went for £8.10. I just didn't get there in time. Just as well, for where I should have put that I really do not know. What fun life is! I do think archaeology is the most fascinating thing in the world. I am still doing my best to be a worthy wife, have drawn one super pot, was taking art lessons as suggested by Max. Black coffee coming in on December the 8th, so I shall have to go up to town for rehearsals next week. I'm really very busy just now. 6 eminent detective story writers have been asked to broadcast again. We're all getting together on December the 5th to plan the thing out a bit. Dorothy Sayers will begin on January the 10th. I shall follow on the 17th, and again on the 31st. All rather fun. Another thing I'm doing is embroidering a peacock. I started it when I was 19 and found it the other day. I feel as though I'd gone back to 19 again. In December, she wrote from the Ladies' Army and Navy Club. Both her houses were let. Just to say that you are my own darling Max, and that I love you frightfully, and I might fill up the page with kisses like children do. Very sweet kisses. I really am frightfully happy, darling. And that's what gives such a zest to everything and makes me feel life is so wonderful. Max replied in kind. Ange, shut your eyes now and pretend that you are in my arms and that I am returning your kisses. The opening of Black Coffee was a particular delight. Madge was there, as Agatha had been at the opening of The Claimant back in 1924. So were Nan and George Conn, and the reviews were good. I like Francis Sullivan better than Charles Laughton as Poirot. He makes him much more lovable, she wrote to Max. On the strength of this success, a play version of The Secret of Chimneys was scheduled to be staged, although this did not happen. But it's exciting anyway. There was even a possibility of work from Hollywood. We might clean up a nice little sum, and with it we'd raise a mound to the ground, which must have sounded like music in Max's ears. Darling Max, why are you so far away? Or why am I? But Rosalind is very pleased to have me. On Christmas Eve, she wrote more soberly. It's my old wedding day today. It's always been a sad day for me, but not this year. Bless you, my darling, for all you have done and given back to me. Agatha went out to the Our for the last time in the spring of 1931. I have written to Catherine and hope all will be well. Rather oddly, but Agatha tended to enjoy displays of forbearance, she dedicated the 13 problems to the Woolies. By this time, Max had a new job lined up with Dr. Campbell Thompson at Nineveh, the 8th century BC capital of the Assyrian Empire. C.T., as he was called, was not an especially clever archaeologist, although he and his wife were easier to deal with than the Woolies. Still, he too thought it his business to vet Agatha before she could be permitted to visit the dig. He also remonstrated with her when she bought a writing table to use at the sparsely furnished dig house at Mosul. Economy was his passion, and he could not understand why Agatha should not write her books on a packing case. What business this was of his, the Lord only knows, although Agatha did not say so. Her good humour in the face of her husband's strange colleagues, who had the dry, petty, rather childlike belief in their superiority that often characterises the intellectual, was remarkable. Perhaps she simply drifted away from it, secure as she was in her own creative world. Anyway, she did not want to make trouble for Max. She strove to get along with C.T. and his wife Barbara, making an effort she had never bothered with when it came to Archie's golfing friends. Max went out to the Nineveh dig in the autumn, and Agatha went alone to Rhodes, where she worked on Lord Edgware Dies before joining her husband at the end of October and finishing the book, dedicated to the Campbell Thompsons, on her table. Her letters to Max had become more lover-like. Before the honeymoon, there had been no talk of the sexual delights that awaited, if indeed these were anticipated. "Don't forget your hot water bottle," Max wrote, and, in his innocence, "I can promise you stiffs all through life." He meant the dead bodies that emerged from archaeological digs. But a year later, Agatha wrote, "Max,
Sometimes I want to sun myself on a hotel beach and bathe with nothing on, in daylight. And then I want to lie on my face in the sun and have you kiss me all down my back. Can we ever do that? Is there any place? We could have in Greece, I believe, only we weren't like that then, were we? This letter rather gives the lie to A.L. Rouse's theory that Agatha and Archie's marriage ended, in part because she lacked sex drive. Agatha was proper, but she was not at all prim. Slip in and gently in, till breast and neck and arms are kissed and swung, she wrote in a wonderfully sexy poem called The Evening Bathe. Swimming was always a voluptuous experience for her, as in 1931 was her second husband. I go to bed so sleepy, I haven't even the energy for sensual thoughts, she wrote in December, when back in England for a hectic Christmas. In Rhodes, meanwhile, she had gone into a cathedral and said a prayer to, I think it was, St. John the Baptist. Not perhaps a very good person to pray to for a son. She wanted a new family, or so she believed. Her own restless, punky, indefatigable Rosalind exhausted and exasperated her. But she was past 40, and her sole pregnancy ended in miscarriage in 1932. Just as well, perhaps, as when Rosalind's child was born, Max would write to Agatha saying how relieved he was not to have a baby and to have all his wife's attention to himself. Not that she had all his attention. In Rhodes, she began to feel that their separate lives might be a cause for concern. Darling, are you real? Or just a dream I had? I'd like you to be here to laugh at me when I come out of the sea all happy like a dog. Suppose I never saw you again. As soon as one loves anyone, one gets afraid, doesn't one? That is why dogs go about growling with a bone. They're convinced it will be taken from them by other dogs. Are there any other dogs at Mosel, darling? Perhaps you'd better not tell me if there are. In fact, Max was far more concerned about his career at this time. But what Agatha had called the wounds were opening again, just a little. She had had one unfaithful husband and was preparing herself for the possibility of another, so much younger after all, although she showed no outward sign of insecurity. She remained the happy, busy, successful Agatha Christie, with her theatrical triumphs and her procession of acclaimed novels. The Sittaford Mystery, Peril at End House, Lord Edgware Dies, Murder on the Orient Express, and Why Didn't They Ask Evans were published between 1931 and 1934, with two sets of short stories, The Listerdale Mystery and Parker Pyne Investigates. This last is an interesting one. Parker Pyne is a specialist in happiness. He runs a business that supplies happiness to discontented people. Although not a detective, he has the quality of omniscience that Agatha found so irresistible, and he is both wise and kind. He is visited, for example, by a middle-aged wife whose husband is staying with a pretty young secretary. The situation is presented as too familiar to be distressing, a consoling idea in itself, and the solution is simple. The wife must smarten herself up and conduct a harmless romance of her own. This works so well at bringing the husband back into line that Agatha must have wondered whether she should have done the same thing with Archie. For it was Archie who was on her mind. Why otherwise should she have written Unfinished Portrait? She had been busy enough already in 1933. In that year alone, she had produced Orient Express, Why Didn't They Ask Evans? Some of the stories in the Listerdale Mystery, others were reprints from magazines, and Parker Pyne Investigates. Her urgent desire to write, which had relaxed its grip in the first 2 years of her marriage, was burning again. And what she wanted to do was revisit memory. She wanted to be the one to open the wounds. She was a writer. Only a writer would behave in such a way. So out it all came again. The idyll of childhood, the beloved mother and husband, the end of the world. How could she bear to write it? She bore it because that was what Mary Westmacott did. She had helped Max achieve the goal of his own dig.
After a season at Nineveh, he was now in charge at Apakeia in Iraq, which he excavated for 1 year only due to the political situation in 1933. Agatha did drawings and described herself as bursting with happiness when our pimple of a mound proved to contain some magnificent pottery. She enjoyed herself, although her son-in-law described her attitude to archaeological life thus. Max liked it, so Agatha liked it. Meanwhile, she planned unfinished portrait, that hymn of love to the past. At the end of the book, she described the man who wanted to marry her after her divorce. He told me that what I needed was gentleness. He'd been unhappy too. He understood what it was like. We enjoyed things together. We seemed to be able to share things, and he didn't mind if I was myself. I mean, I could say I was enjoying myself and be enthusiastic without his thinking me silly. He was, it's an odd thing to say, but he really was like a mother to me. A part of her wants to marry the man Michael, but in the book she does not do so. Her fear of being hurt is too great. She tries again to kill herself and is rescued. Then she goes out into the world to face an unknown future. She went back, at 39, to grow up, writes the narrator of the book, and she left her story and her fear with me. This, perhaps, was how Agatha felt when she reached the end of Unfinished Portrait. The past was now the past, buried within words. But of course it was not so simple. I am tired of the past that clings around my feet. I am tired of the past that will not let life be sweet. I would cut it away with a knife and say, let me be myself, reborn today. But I am afraid of the past, that it will creep back to my feet and look in my face and say, you laugh and eat, but I am here with you yet. You would not remember, but I will not let you forget. What is or is not courage? Who shall say? Shall I be brave or base if I cut the past away?